And we are live. Welcome, folks, to episode 3306. And yeah, it sounds like 3006 to me, too, because I like guns. And we will talk about guns today and a bunch of other stuff. It is officially a listener feedback and Q&A session for 5-23-23. There we go with numeric patterns again. Here's what I've got for you today. A real quick one and a little funny story that involves Ken Berry. They now have candy based on garbage junk food. And I mean the most garbage junk food on the planet. Well, let's just brand it as candy. You might not really follow that, but you will when I show it to you. Some of you saw the picture on either Noster or the Telegram group or elsewhere. It's pretty gross. The most common emoji was a vomiting emoji when I shared this. And it didn't look that disgusting. It's knowing what it is and reading the label that makes it that disgusting. Then a question that was asked during a VA intake, and the guy that sent me the email, he seems to take it as just, I don't know, maybe a curiosity or something. I actually find this, because it was on a questionnaire, to maybe be a probing question, and you have to ask yourself, is VA analyzing our veterans for signs of mental illness or predisposition to be an evil, scary prepper or something like that? We'll see. I'll tell you about that. How to deal with algae and nasty buildup in your duck water tubs. As many of you guys know, since I don't have a big enough pond that ducks can just swim in freely every day, I have to give them water every day. And I've integrated the way I do that into my entire system. I use 21-gallon concrete mixing trays you can get from Home Depot and Lowe's. They're about 10 bucks a piece. And they're a way better solution than kiddie pools. They last a hell of a lot longer. They do a bunch of other stuff. But they do get, well, nasty and gross. And I mean to the point where you dump them out and they're heavy. Like, not heavy, you can't lift, but, like, that's way heavier than it's supposed to be. What do you do about it? It is stupid, simple solution. Stupid, simple. So easy. I have a question about, and this is not the first time somebody's floated this, and I'll tell you why I don't think it's a good idea. If I just use a software wallet like Coinami or Exodus, and I just delete it from a device, save my passphrase, can I call that cold storage? Sort of, kind of, not really, and no. And it also, well, it adds a layer of risk. It adds a layer of risks that I don't think makes a lot of sense to do so. And I'll tell you why I think it's worth 100, 200 bucks once you have enough Bitcoin to really worry about, or crypto if you're storing other crypto, to worry about, you know, where you're actually worried, like I could lose it. Like, it's not a couple hundred bucks. It's not a good night out on a weekend. It's significant why it's worth spending some money to insure it with a hardware wallet like a Seed Signer, a Trezor, a BitBox, or what have you, cold card. I really don't care what you use. As long as you don't use Ledger, I've taken them off the Bitcoin Tools page at Bitcoin Breakout, and I will explain why when we get there. I don't think if you have a Ledger, you should start freaking out right now. But when a company does something stupid, I say stop doing business with that company. And they did something stupid, and it ain't woke. It's directly related to their core mission, which is even worse. When a company that makes beer brings in a transgendered, a fake transgendered, by the way, TikToker, that can create a backlash of boycott from people that are angry. And that is one thing. But if Budweiser did something stupid with their beer, that would even be dumber. Well, Ledger did something stupid in the world of Bitcoin and crypto backups, and I'll tell you about that when we get there. Question on home defense shotguns, storing it, and dealing with California's laws. I can only go so far with that. I've even got some props back here that we'll talk about this one with. Question on making compost tea from worm compost. Tell you straight up front, no problems with that, but I'll give you the context, and I'll tell you why I think it's actually a fantastic way to make compost tea. I mean, an absolute fantastic way. An absolute fantastic thing. Even if you're doing regular compost tea, if you have, and I don't mean worm castings you got in a bag that sat on shelf for 6 months. I mean, if you have a worm farm like this guy does, I think you should always include some of your worm castings in your compost tea, even if it's not done yet. It'll make perfect sense, I think, when I explain it. Thoughts on biochar on a septic system? I'm not sure on this one. I know it won't help this guy. I really don't think it will anyway. His problem is not something biochar would fix. But a septic system that somewhere along the lines incorporated biochar, I don't know if there's one that it's ideal to add it to, but maybe as you look at off-grid building and stuff, there's a way to do this. Some of you engineering types out there, we know have a few hundred of you or more in the audience because I hear from you all the time. Maybe you'll have some ideas on this one. Question from Joel at Fortress Canine about Bitcoin. It ain't really about Bitcoin. It's about data security. And could Bitcoin's blockchain be used to secure data? I know exactly where this comes from because he sent me a list of podcasts he's listened to lately, and he was part of the impetus for yesterday's episode on AI. And I happen to have listened to some podcasts with Mike Saylor where this came up and the whole Ordinals debacle. And I actually think the answer is yes. I have some commentary on that. How do you make a margarita that doesn't suck? Apparently, Jack said a few times on the air, when I go out to eat, if it's a place I haven't been before and don't have them trained already, I always got to teach a bartender how to make a margarita that doesn't suck and doesn't go in a fishbowl. And I've talked about what it is before to make a margarita. It's basically a lime and tequila martini, if you do it right. It doesn't go in a fishbowl. But this guy's only heard the fishbowl part, wanted to know. I thought this would be a little fun, lighthearted topic because we got a kind of deeper than you think topic at the end. We got an article out. It looks like a youngish millennial, not a Gen Zer, but definitely writes for the Gen Z crowd. Good journalist, by the way. I'm not picking on her. About how a flood of boomers retiring will create a permanent labor shortage. Well, will it? Or something else? Jack, didn't you tell us yesterday AI is going to take a bunch of jobs? It will. It's gonna. It absolutely will. We are heading for... If you're old enough, you might remember a thing called stagflation from the 70s, where interest rates were high, right? And unemployment was high, but inflation was low. That's why they call it stagflation. And prices were actually repressed. The economy got so bad, and we didn't just pump money back then, even though we'd already opened the faucet in 71. We didn't just pump it like they do today. So they couldn't really, and even when they tried pumping some in, they couldn't really kickstart inflation because the economy just sucked that bad. Think about that not as a direct corollary, but a metaphor for a time when we maybe have a labor shortage and high unemployment at the same time. How is that possible? If you ain't figured it out yet, I will tell you all about it in just a bit. Before we get into that, let's hear from our sponsors of the day. Sponsor of the day, number one today. It's BulkAmmo.com. I've been telling you for over 10 years now. That's how long they've been around. More than 10 years. Bulk Ammo is the place to get your ammunition quick, fast, efficient, and great pricing. But I thought I would point out something today. Bulk Ammo actually has some cool stuff that is stuff that maybe you don't normally think of. And it's useful, too. It's not just, you know, generic stuff. This is 1,000 rounds right here, $420, 9mm ammunition. And this is 124-grain non-incendiary visual tracer. What the hell is that? Well, if you fire tracer rounds at certain things, you can set them on fire. I got to do that once on a rifle range on purpose in the military. It's kind of cool, doing it at night especially. But what this does, and it would need to be a lower light situation to do this. We used this exact technology. When I was in the Army, when we trained with the AT-4, and we fired a little bitty 9mm round, the drill sergeant loaded with a stick in the back of the AT-4, and it left a trace, and we did it during low light conditions so you could actually see it. It's just a little bit of chemical on the back that reflects light back at you so you can see where the round goes. It was pretty cool. You could go down on one knee with a mocked-up AT-4, and you could hit an ATV at about 300 meters out. It would go... Tink, like a pellet gun when it hit it. But this is good for training as long as you're training in low enough light. And most indoor ranges it would provide that for you. It's not incendiary. Some ranges are uber tight, so you might need to check before you do that. But it's just something to consider. And then there was another one. I wanted to show you these guys here. These are synthetic jacketed 9mm. Now, why would you do synthetic jacketed anything? Federal makes these. I'm not saying to run out and buy a bunch of them right away, but they make different ammo and different rounds in it. And the reason is for the high volume practicing person that's firing a lot of rounds out of the same gun, that synthetic jacket does a lot less wear on your barrel. Now, is it worth the premium on cost? I don't think there's much of a premium on cost. So I wouldn't carry these for personal defense, but I'll tell you right now. So I just wanted to kind of point out today that there's more to bulkammo.com than a lot of ammo cheap and high availability and fast shipping. There's also some cool stuff there. Next up, the other precious metal, copper jacketed lead from JM Bullion. They've got some really cool stuff, guys. If you just want to stack silver, look, there's a 100-ounce bar right there on your screen. Silver, gold, platinum, even copper. Check it all out today. What I really love, though, in getting kids to understand money is all of the cool silver rounds that they have. Because kids, you know, they like things like, well, Indian heads and all kinds of cool stuff. They even have Bitcoin rounds. Ah, quick story about my granddaughter. She got something Easter. So it's going back a bit. In one of the little plastic Easter eggs, it was a fake plastic Bitcoin. And she's like, I got Bitcoin. I got to talk to Papa Jack now. See, kids react to stuff like this. I really recommend that you start stacking some silver, Bitcoin as well for your kiddos. But this is a really great way to do that. You know, every birthday, every big event when kids are getting crap, pick them up a couple different cool silver rounds. We actually got my grandson a cool treasure chest to keep his stuff in. And start teaching them the value of real money. It's just a great way to go. And we do have a question already from Bill. I've got it started, Bill. And just a reminder to everybody, if you're going to ask me questions when I am by myself, it is really important that you use all caps for the first few words if you do. And I would tell you, I caught yours too, Marco, but when I'm doing screen share, I'm not on the same screen where I see the chat, and I'm a lot less likely to see it. So I would put your questions up when I'm not sharing my screen. I think you'll find that'll work a lot better for you. And with that, I want to actually share something on my screen with you, and I want to tell you a funny Ken Berry story at the same time. So the way this starts is I'm cruising my butt up, because I'm heading I'm northbound on I-35, heading back from Bastrop. I was about halfway home. I had stopped at Bucky's. I was going to pick some stuff up there, some jerky and some pepper beef and stuff like that. I walked in there, and I used their admittedly, if you're ever in the areas where Bucky's stores are, cleanest, largest, best bathrooms on the road that there are. So I stopped there. It was like Disneyland collided with a major movie showing or something. Everybody was there. It was hell for a person like me to be surrounded by that many people that don't know where they're going. I weaved my way through, used the facilities, and left. So bit up from there. I was kind of hungry. Stopped at a Cracker Barrel, not the best choice, but you can get bacon and sausage and eggs. So I did that, and I had to wait a few minutes for my table. So I'm wandering around in the gift shop, and he's been to Cracker Barrel, knows they got a gift shop. My wife loves her gift shop. And I see this, and if you're on the live feed right now, Grumpy Green Guy says, Bucky is bigoted toward truckers. No, Bucky's does not allow 18-wheelers in their facility because they don't serve 18-wheelers and because they're full enough on people. Anyway, that's not bigotry. That's choosing a market segment that you serve. Anyway, so I'm in Cracker Barrel, and I see this thing, and you're not missing reading it there. Gummy Lunchables. Now, when I posted this, somebody pointed out to me that more than 15 years ago, mainstream media did a deep dive into food that people give their kids for school and determined the most disgusting, revolting, sickest thing you could give your kid was Lunchables, based on chemicals and additives and stuff like that. That's when I halfway still told the truth anyway. So they took one of the shittiest things that people feed their children right now, and they turned it into gummy candy, and it looks absolutely revolting and disgusting. And if you think it's just a coincidence, if you don't think they're trying to ingrain brands in the head of our children as young as possible, you would be wrong. Yeah, that's Kraft macaroni and cheese in the blue box. It really is. And it's a gummy candy, and that is a gummy hot dog behind it. And those are gummy pizzas to the left, also branded. I don't remember what the brand was on them. And there's a bunch more of this crap. Look, I'll be honest. When it comes to candy, my weakness is gummy stuff, all right? I love gummy bears, the good ones. Kind John Willis sells with his stuff. I think there's a place for candy as long as it's not all the time. However, a giant box of macaroni and cheese flavored gummies is not something you should be giving your kids. And even worse would be a giant meal kit of gummies that are supposed to look like crap. I mean, it's just nasty. It's nasty. And I know that, like, you know, the good gummy bears I'm talking about, like the ones made in Germany and shit, like, I know that ain't what it is. This is the lowest end of the lowest end of gummy candies. So while I don't want to eat a lot of gummy candies, I do accept that they can taste really good. But kids, all you got to do is pour enough sugar on something and they'll eat it. My point here is you need to protect your children, as I keep telling you, from these people on your television set, from these corporate oligarchs, from the corporatocracy. This is a sick thing. But the funny part of it is, I took those two pictures and I texted them to our friend Ken Berry. And I said, Ken, I hope this doesn't give you an aneurysm when you see it. He texted back a one-word response. It was, and I have to say it, I say the F word a lot anyway, but I'm warning you it's coming. Fuckers. That was his entire response. Well, here it comes again. Thing is, by then I was back in Val. That's the name I've given my challenger. Hauling ass home, and it comes up. I'm listening to a podcast that there's a text message. I hit it so that Siri will read it to me, and it says, Ken Berry said, fuckers. All cheery the way Siri is. Would you like to reply? And I said no, and I really wish I could have recorded that because you can't make it happen on purpose again. It gave me a good chuckle. Hope it gave you one. All right, so now let's talk about this thing about VA asking a question. So I try not to try to read the emails on the other screen. I try to just, from my brain, remember the gist of it. So if I don't get everything exactly right in any of these questions you send them in, I'm doing my best to make these universal anyway. So guy goes to VA during the intake. Nurse is asking him a series of questions, and she asked him if he was worried about the food supply and did he feel he had enough food. Now, there's a few reasons that you could legitimately ask this question. One would be, we have a lot of homeless veterans out there, and those guys do worry about food. But, you know, that would be more a question about your lifestyle than are you worried about food? Are you worried about food? Do you have enough food? He responded with, it depends on the weather. That threw her for a loop. And she said, well, why does it depend on the weather? And he said, because that affects my garden. So she wrote that down as a no. And he said he should have offered her some seeds and he missed a chance. I've been hearing, though, some of these questions that are being asked for our veterans. And I get an inkling, and I could be wrong. Sometimes I'm like, I know this, or I'm 90% sure. I just have a feeling here that our veterans are being targeted for lists, like docile and not a threat, possibly a threat, potentially a threat, high probability of a threat. And I base that on a lot of information I've been getting, and I base it on, you know, public statements by the government that one of their biggest fears is, you know, veterans. So I don't really know exactly if that was part of it. But I get that feeling. I get that feeling that our government looks to anybody who has the capability to resist them as a threat. And while veterans were trained by that same government, veterans have a definite understanding of what the government is. And I will tell you, as a veteran, this is what I think happens. Most people go in the military between the age of 17 and 22. Especially males, we're pretty freaking stupid at that point in our lives. And if you join the military at that age, there's a high probability that you're America, fuck yeah, kind of guy, right? And you believe in your country and mama and apple pie and all that good stuff, and you really believe in what you're doing. Because I've said this before, it takes someone different to willingly sacrifice a significant amount of their freedom and to go into service for a job that don't pay any more than it does to work full time at Walmart. There are some other benefits, yes, but there's a corresponding group of things you give up. And even as dumb as you are, when you're 17, 18, 19-year-old kid out of high school and you put your hand up and solemnly swear, you do understand, you may not understand everything, but you understand that you're giving up a lot. So when that veteran comes out, they generally have a totally different view of things, but they're generally still pretty stringent on, don't talk shit about my country, I'll kick your ass if you disrespect my flag, all that shit. As they mature, because most people go in at 17 to 22, and most people go in for 4 to 6 years, and most people do one. That doesn't mean there's not a lot of people to reenlist. I'm just telling you that the majority of people do not do a second term. And a significant majority definitely don't do a third. There's a lot of people do 4 and 6, or 6 and 4, or 6 and a 2-year extension. A lot of people coming out somewhere between 4 years and 10 years of service. And you're still, if you went in at 18, and you did a full 10, you're only 28. And when you're 50, you realize how young that is. And that older person who's a little more considerate about what's going on around their life starts to analyze what's going on through a different lens. And they really quickly snap to, oh, I see what's going on here. And that rah-rah, you know, full-on, my patriotism starts to wane the longer you're out and the more reality you see. And the government knows we've now got a person trained to see our shit, trained to defend themselves with violence effectively if necessary, who's not going to tolerate us anymore. And I think they have an awful lot of fear from their own soldiers. And this is not new. This is why it's both a good thing, but there's a nefarious reason behind it. Soldiers who retired during the Roman Empire were given land far the hell away from Rome, far the hell away from any of the bigger cities and city-states within the empire, so that they would go away and do something and not be a threat and be separated, by the way. They didn't put them all in a place together, right? They gave each of them their own little place and separated them out. Because it's a pacification strategy. It actually was good for them, I think, as well. And I would be for doing that for our veterans today because I think they need something to do. But that's why it was done then. And so government not trusting its soldiers after service is as old as governments and service to government itself is. Just some thoughts. Next up, I had a guy email me and say, you know, I followed your example. I went to Lowe's, bought some of those big 21-gallon trays, the concrete mixing trays you use for your ducks. Been using them a while now. Ducks love them. They work great. They hold up good, just like you said. But they're pretty gross now. They're coated in algae and duck poo. And, you know, I don't want to sit there and scrub the damn things. But what do? Do I not worry about it? Well, here's the thing. It's so simple. Dump them out. And then take a couple on any given day that are nasty. Don't fill them up. Lean them up against something pointing in the general direction the sun comes from that day. Let that sun beat on them for a day, and that algae will just dry up to nothing. And it'll be perfect like it's brand new. It might be a little white or something in it, but overall, it'll be completely cleaned out because they do, if you let this go a while, I've done it where you pick one up, you're like, you're not looking when you pick it up, and you're like, is there still water in there? And it's just that there's so much wet algae or other duck stuff in there that happens. And so what I do is I generally use about 12 trays. I don't need that many, but I do that because especially in the summer, we strategically move them. We've integrated it into our total plan. So where certain trees are, there'll be a tub that day. And then they'll move to the next tree and the next tree and the next tree. And so about every 2 weeks, each tree within the system gets a good 20-gallon dump of not just water, but duck poop-infused water. But I don't really need 12. So if they start to get nasty, I'll pull 2 or 4 of them out for a day and let them dry out. The other thing you can do that will really help and prevent you from having to do it, if you remember to do it and you integrate it into your system, dump them at night after your ducks go to bed and just leave them upside down. In the morning, move them to their new spot, leave them upside down overnight, flip them back up and fill them in the morning. And that'll prevent that. Or if you have your grandson do it like I do, you make him do everything. So that's one of his chores that he has to do around here. And that's it. That's how simple it is. Moving on from there, guy asked me if I got a software wallet for my Bitcoin and I got all my Bitcoin onto my software wallet and then I just delete my software wallet from my device, but I save my recovery phrase so I can recover it. Isn't that the same as a cold storage wallet? Not really, but yeah, really. Sort of, but I don't recommend it. What I see there is somebody, assuming you have enough Bitcoin to think this way, say $4,000 or $5,000 or more, you're trying to save $200 on an insurance policy is pretty much permanent by adding a layer of risk rather than removing a layer of risk in return for $200. And to me, that just doesn't make sense. So the issue there is, as long as you have your recovery phrase, you can recover your Bitcoin. That's true. But now if you lose your recovery phrase, you're really screwed. Well, if I lose my recovery phrase, am I not really screwed anyway? Well, not if you have a hardware wallet, and the odds that you lose both at the same time are pretty low. You see how that works? I can either access my Bitcoin with my wallet, and as long as I remember my pass key for my wallet, if somehow my phrase gets destroyed, I can get my phrase off my wallet. It's a couple layers deep to protect people from finding it or whatever, but I can do it. Where if I just have the phrase and I lose the wallet, I've got a problem. This would be a strategy. It's a risk strategy, but it would be a strategy for somebody like fleeing a country, right? Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to get thoughts on Ledger. And I think Builder of Castles covered it pretty good there and said that Ledger went full retard. That's, if anybody knows the movie, that's a good way to put it. But that would be a good strategy. Let's say I had to flee a country and I know I'm going to get shaken down. And, you know, I might want to spend a week or two fully ingraining that phrase into my head. I might even want to plant it somewhere or in pieces, parts somewhere where I can recover it digitally and do it in some way that if I forget, I have some way to remind myself. But if somebody got any piece of it, they wouldn't be able to know what it was or do what it was. And it would be a risk, but it's a better idea than leaving your country and not having your wealth. Yeah, that is how that strategy is taken. I just don't think it's a good idea. I really don't. And it also then means that I have to go through a recovery process before I can spend Bitcoin. And it means that the only way I can continue to deposit Bitcoin onto that wallet would be to basically have the addresses be the same over and over again. There's a way around it, but if you knew how to do that, you wouldn't ask this question, right? Where with my hardware wallet, and I had it out today because of this topic, I've got some props today. With my hardware wallet, stays locked in a fire safe, but using the interface with my software wallet, I can generate new receive addresses anytime I want without taking out the hardware wallet. So if you're a person that's using Bitcoin, I think it's an even worse strategy. My strategy is I use a Lightning wallet, I use a software wallet, and I use a hardware wallet to secure the money that I manage with the software wallet. I think it's worth a little bit of extra money, and I wouldn't not do it. Now, Joe's asking me thoughts on Ledger, and I said I would cover it when I got here. Here's what Ledger did for those not paying attention. Ledger, first of all, suggests that people walk around with either a wallet or a phrase around their neck, a USB stick, which was stupid. But then they went, in the words of Builder of Castles here, full retard. like Tropic Thunder level full retard. They went, no, I don't think the state had anything to do with this because it wouldn't benefit the state for them to have done this. They have an encrypted cloud service that lets you store your recovery phrase in an encrypted cloud service, and they're suggesting their users do it. Now, let me explain something. They're not making anybody do it. You have to choose to do it. But any company that fancies themselves a Bitcoin company that would suggest to you that you store your phrase in the cloud has, in the words, once again, a builder of castles, gone full on all the way over the top retard. And you should not do business with them anymore. Now, what does that mean if you have a Ledger wallet right now and you're happy with it? Don't use the service. And whenever you're ready, upgrade your wallet, buy something else. I wouldn't freak out about this. I don't have a backdoor. I mean, all this stuff's been analyzed by every hacker in the business. It's not that. It's that they offered a service that shows that they're stupid and they're not putting the best interests of their people that are their customers first. And what I think it really comes down to is if you're a Bitcoin or crypto hardware device manufacturer, you don't have a lot of repeat business, and these guys are trying to skin out an idea for repeat business. I just, you know, that's not the way to do it, Ledger. Surely there's something else you can do. You can come up with something that's so feature-rich that people want to upgrade. I don't know what it is you guys need to do, because it is important that a vendor you rely on have a way to continue growing, because if you don't grow in business, eventually you go out of business. So I don't know. Trezor seems to get by okay without doing all this stupidity. So anyway, let's go on to the next one. So this is another one I got some variety of props for. Guy emailed me, and he's got a couple different problems that are all around the same issue. One is the state of California and its laws. I don't know the state of California's laws on trigger locks, securing guns, etc. I can't really address that. I'm not an attorney. I don't want to be one. I will try to give you as much information as I can. This gentleman chooses to use a shotgun as his primary home defense weapon, and he wants a reliable way to secure it, hide it, but yet have it rapidly available. And I'll do what I can there. I'm going to start out with, I love the shotgun. And I love it as a defensive tool in a lot of situations. If I know there's a threat and I can get my shotgun versus my handgun and I know there's a threat, I'm going to go for the shotgun if I have a choice. So don't take anything else I'm about to say to be derogatory toward the shotgun as a home defense tool. There was a study. It was an informal study done by an individual who simply raked data out of news stories and people that were attacked or attacked somebody and got shot. And his conclusion was, when someone gets shot with a shotgun, they're more likely to stop what they're doing than anything else. It was shotgun rifles, and all the handguns, like from 22 to 45, performed remarkably the same. If the question was, how many times you got to shoot somebody before they stop trying to kill you? Okay. So shotguns make people dead or at least stop the shit they're pulling, okay? Because even a lot of the people that died in that study, they still injured or killed the other party before they expired, even though they were injured. So I'm all about it. I get it. However, I'm laying in bed. Now, this ain't going to happen here because the place is fenced and you ain't getting in. And you're probably bit if you try. But you live in a suburban neighborhood, middle of the night, somebody knocks on your door, 2:00 in the morning. There's a chance somebody broke down, saw your porch light on, and needs help. Somebody's dying in the street. I mean, I don't want to not respond. I'm going to be careful about it, and I'm going to be armed. It is much easier for me to approach that situation, because it could be the police as well. And they see me with a gun. We know how trigger-happy some cops get. I didn't say all, some of you guys, but I said some. So being able to conceal my defensive tool in that situation is valuable. So my first line of defense for home defense is a good handgun. And it makes it the question you're asking easier to solve. However, I like me some shotguns and rifles, as you see back there. So let's start off with how I would recommend you keep your shotgun, the condition you keep your shotgun in this situation. Okay, if you had a trigger lock, you have another level of complexity. So I'm going to reach back, and this is not what I would use for home defense. This is a cool little Mossberg 410, and all of you safety police, it's not loaded in. It's kept with the chamber open. I'm going to close it now, and I'm going to re-clear it a couple times so you don't get all antsy and pantsy. But there's a way of carrying a shotgun that cops do a lot. It's called cruiser ready, and I do think it makes a lot of sense. And the way you would do that is you would close your shotgun. You would go ahead and release the firing pin. I personally recommend leaving the slide unlocked, okay, if you have a slide lock. You load the tube, and if it's a pump, all you have to do is pump it. If it's a semi-auto, all you have to do is rack it, and you're ready to fire. Safety on, right? And you are, I mean, you're, bam. You don't have to release anything or anything like that. All you have to do is work the action, and you're ready to go. And then I recommend extra ammo and an ammo carrier on the side if it's a defensive shotgun. And so that's the gun itself, how I would have it stored. Again, clear it out, firing pin down, magazine loaded, tucked away. If you have a trigger lock, it's one more thing to deal with. But if it's a law and you're worried you might get searched or something and have your house raided, then maybe it's worth not having a felony. Because, again, I don't know what the law is in California. And I'll show you a trigger guard that I recommend next. All right. So moving on from there. There is an entire industry around building furniture, hide boxes, etc. I'm going to show you one I really like right now for those of you in the video. This is kind of cool. It does kind of give itself away just a little bit because of what's on it. And this is not designed to be walked around with. This is designed to be bolted to a wall. And if you open it up, well, looky there. What about that? There's a little 9mm tucked away in there, okay? And so this goes on a wall. This is not secure because it's not locked. But it goes on a wall if it's bolted to a wall, and it's really quick to deploy, right? There are all types of cabinets, dresser drawers, things like that where weapons can be stored. Some of them actually have biometric integration. So that, like, there's a drawer that comes out, but you swipe a finger or whatever. I don't know. Maybe it's because I'm old. Maybe it's because I grew up. I was 6 years old cleaning deer rifles for my parents. I believe in training kids to not do things with guns that they shouldn't do with guns. And then to make sure you're monitoring to make sure that that's happening. And to tell you that if they want to know about a gun, if they want to shoot a gun, if they want to touch a gun, they want to clean a gun, they want to work with a gun, they want to learn about it, come to you, and you'll do it together. And over time, you build a relationship between that child and firearms that is built on safety and trust, and it's earned across time, so that by the time you have a kid that's 16 years old and you hand him a shotgun and take a bird dog and go out in the field, he doesn't shoot you in the face like Dick Cheney, okay? So I don't get uber uptight about, oh, kids, guns, whatever. But you do want to use certain things. Like those two guns back there, you know one of the things I can tell you about them? If you want to fire either one of those in my house, you are going to work really hard, really, really hard, and you're going to need keys to find any ammunition that fits either one of them. Because those are not defensive guns. They're not what we're talking about. Let's be honest, too, with a defensive gun, how many do you need in the condition we're talking about, ready to deploy as quick as possible? I would say at maximum per person, too. A long and a handgun, whether you have a carbine or a shotgun and a handgun for home defense. That's a maximum I think anybody needs in quickly deployable, bump in the night response situation. So that means that all your other guns can have other forms of security that are more stringent. Like most of mine are locked away very, very securely. Yeah. Okay. So we only need to worry about them. Now, there's a whole industry, though, again, of things like I've seen stuff that looks like the footboard of a bed it replaces, and you can roll out of bed and have a shotgun in seconds. Now, I'm going to show you if I had to have a trigger lock in a weapon that I not just any weapon, a weapon that I want to be able to rapidly deploy, what I would recommend. They're made by a company called Viking. They're very, very well thought of. They're designed where they work for pretty much every model of firearm. They'll go on rifles, pistols, shotguns, handguns. They're ambidextrous in that they can go onto that weapon in either direction, right? So if you lefties, you're not swapping over or something. They're $100 a piece. That seems expensive, but again, how many do you need? I don't have any relationship with these people, but if I had to secure a weapon that I needed deployable, this is what I would go with. I'm also interested in you guys, right? What you would do in this situation. Many of us, I think, we're single. We don't have any kids to worry about. We don't live in a state like California. One way or another, this is a lot of an easier question to answer for us. One of the jobs I had was, at one time when I was really young, I had an office and all, but it was a sketchy place. And I literally had a gun that was tucked up in a device that I made myself under my desk. Now, grumpy green guy says, move. You know what? The dude that wrote me the letter said, I know you're going to say move out of California, but I can't. And I think it's really easy for people to say move when you're not the person that moves. And usually if I ask a person, by the way, if you could live anywhere in the world, if money was not an object, would you live where you are? And they usually, if they're honest, say no. And I say, why don't you go there? And then they tell me all the reasons they can't, but they tell the other guy to move, right? So this guy's got family. He's got a really good paying job. And he's got kids. He don't have the kids no matter where he goes. So one of the things you have to worry about as a father or a mother with kids, people like the CPS assholes, the Rewind was about last week, is that if you're not being safe, and some form of data leak happens, right? Because data leaks aren't always on computers. Some kid says something to some other kid that says something to somebody's mom. You have some clown showing up from the state trying to take your kid away from you because it's not safe. So don't go yammering and yelling and yakking about what other people should do if you're not a person in their exact situation. As Native American would tell you, walk a mile in a man's moccasins before you tell him how he should be living. So that's just I just asked what we would do. And I'm going to tell you, if you were him, you wouldn't. I'm not picking on you, dude. I'm not. It is easy with your name since you're always grumpy. But if you were in his situation, you wouldn't move. What would you do if you were in his situation? That's what I'm actually asking. Like, what do you know of that can make this happen? I would probably, one, somewhat oversecure my shotgun and make it my backup. And I would use a handgun and I would keep it on my body in my house, which is what I generally do now because I'm not worried about somebody getting their hands on it while I'm carrying it. And I would secure that. I would exactly tell you how and where I secure my handgun at night, but I don't want to give away that information. And I would make it immediately deployable for myself. And I wouldn't worry about somebody searching the house because at any time somebody would be searching the house, since it's my carry gun, it wouldn't be in that place, if that makes sense, right? So I ain't picking on you if you took it that way. I understand what you're saying. That's what I would do, but no, I'm saying you can't. You're in his situation. You live in California. You have a shotgun. You want to use it as your defensive tool. You have kids. You're worried about having an unsecured gun around your kids, but yet you want it to be rapidly deployable. I've seen things that look like a lot like that one I just showed you about my pistol, a picture that opens up, that are long, look really cool. Pop it open, there's a shotgun in there. There is also a lot of furniture being made today that's not for guns, but it works really well for guns. And so a lot of like your night tables and stuff now, they'll come with a bottom drawer that doesn't look like a drawer that you can like stick your foot under and pull it out, or you can reach down and do it. And you're pretty shallow. And the main reason that furniture manufacturers make them is for jewelry to be hidden. because the guy breaks in your house. He's moving as fast as he can. They pull drawers out. They're in a hurry, and they're less likely to get that. And Joe says a revolver. And, yeah, a revolver and certainly just about any semi-auto handgun, in any of them I've ever seen, are deep enough for either of those to work, unless you're talking like a dirty, hairy Ruger Red Hawk or something, might be a little tight on the diameter of the cylinder. So that would be another thing to consider. I would really move toward a handgun as your primary defensive tool. I do it for different reasons. But if I'm worried about kids and laws, this is just an easier thing to handle. I'll tell you a story. I don't even want to say who it is because some of you would know him, but I have someone that I'm associated with that's in law enforcement. And I was staying at this person's house, and they have a home security system that they arm all the time because they're a cop, and they think everybody steals all the time. And they told me how to arm it and disarm it, and I came home, and I disarmed it. And it rearmed itself some weird way after I closed it. And the motion detectors knew I was there. And he knew I was there. And he heard me come in. And he heard the system disarm and rearm. So he knew it probably wasn't a problem. This guy's a cop. He comes running down the stairs with a service weapon with a cable trigger lock through the action in one hand, carrying it by the cable, and his magazine in the other hand. I didn't say anything. And I don't need to say anything else. But you guys know, if you're really worried, how dumb that is. And further, since he knew it was probably me, it could have started out with, "Hey, Jack, is that you?" Instead of running down the stairs carrying the two parts of the gun that need to go together to go bang. I don't know where the key was, maybe in his mouth. Right? So that's all I'm going to say on that. Let's move on from there. Another guy emailed me and said, "You know, I follow Elaine Ingham. She's awesome. Talks a lot about making compost tea. I make massive amounts of compost. The guy's got rabbits. I'm a little jealous of not having rabbits. I don't want to do the work and nobody will eat them but me. But, I mean, if I had a neighbor with rabbits, I'd take all the rabbit poo that he could give me. I mean, it's just an amazing fertilizer and some other stuff. That's out there, chicken waste, all the stuff he has. He makes his regular compost, probably. That's his great big worm compost setup. And he says he's heard Elaine talk about making compost tea over and over again. She's never talked about making it from worms. You know, can you make it from worm compost? I don't know what Elaine thinks about this. And here's what I think about Elaine. If you're a strawberry farmer and you want to learn how to make the exact right compost and compost tea mixture, specifically for strawberries, you want to follow Elaine Ingham's highly scientific methodology. If you want to do it for avocados or turf grass or anything, or a specific soil type that you want to alter in a certain way in its structure, that's how good she is at what she does. If you're a gardener and you want to do all that crap, go ahead. Most of us just make some compost and use it. It's going to be okay. If you have problems with compost, you probably have a problem with the source of the material you're making your compost with. Like if you're using hay that was sprayed with Crazon, you're going to have a problem. Yeah? So that, just be sure of your materials, make your compost, and go on with your life. We've been doing it forever and a day. It's not that hard. And it's not, I'm not at all pushing away what Elaine does. I'm just making the point that you don't need to do all that to make good compost. By the way, I got Michael Whitman coming on tomorrow. We're going to be talking about stuff other than biochar, even though he's highly known for biochar. And I bet you he concurs with that because of the way he's making his compost. As far as the question, then, I don't know what Elaine would say, but I'm going to say, yeah, put worm compost into your compost tea. And I would say it's good to make compost tea, worm compost tea, or combination thereof. And I'll tell you why. People think that a worm bin, it's just worms eating stuff and pooping it out. That's all worm compost is. Worm compost, and I'm talking about sticky, fresh, worm-casting compost, is some of the most bioactive compost on the planet. It's not that high in NPK. It's like a 1-1-1 or a 2-1-5-1 or something like that. And I'm sure that varies, so that's why the numbers you get vary. It's the life. It's the life. A compost tea can't be that high in nutrient. Take a little bit of compost, make 5 gallons out of it, and then dilute the 5 gallons into 35 gallons. Don't think for a minute that you're putting a high NPK on your plants when they explode with growth after you did it. It's the life. It's the life that it creates on the plants, cellular level integration with the plants on the leaves, the stems, et cetera, and in the soil and infusing that life. Green Country Agroforestry says lots of EM in there. For those that don't know what that is, that is effective microorganisms. And correct me if I'm wrong, Green Country, but I think generally when people say EM that you buy, you're talking about anaerobes that you do something like make a Boschi box with or something like that. So I guess if you just use the term in general, effective microbes, yeah, there's a lot of effective microbes in there. But most of what's in a worm bin is going to be aerobic because the worms keep everything aerated. And it's just and you'll inevitably find in your worm bin other little critters. You'll find springtails. I've done a lot with terrariums and stuff in the past, living vivariums for amphibians and stuff, and a soil bed in a vivarium, and you can buy, like, there's people that, like, they nerd out on certain types of springtails. They're little tiny soil organisms. They're not microbes. You can see them, but they're pretty small to get excited about one being a certain color or something like that. People do. And so you can buy them. Any kind of herp enthusiast website or something will sell them. And I'll add those, but they'll usually show up. You can throw roly-polies in there if you want, any decomposer, and you will find inevitably in a worm bin other things, especially if it's an outdoor or shop-building worm bin. And all of that is contributing to this microorganism fiesta. And there's a ton of fungal breakdown in worm bins. Now, if we turbocharge this, and this is what I'm getting ready to do, is to build a black soldier fly system. And we start taking black soldier fly frost and making it input to a composting worm bin. The micro load in that is insane. Living Web Farms has some great webinars, and I found one on black soldier fly. And the guy that was teaching was a really smart dude, and he started talking about how that works in conjunction with moving that frost over to the worm bins and how much micro. So I'm saying go all in on it. I'll also say, he said the frost from black soldier fly is really not ready to be compost yet or to be, you know, added to soil. Something should be done with it first. I have a friend who buys duck eggs from us, and he made some compost tea out of that frost and I believe some other compost. I believe some worm compost as well, but it wasn't frost through it and then compost tea. It was frost, other compost together, make compost tea. I don't know if that's a generally safe practice, but he bought me a bottle of the concentrated tea. And everything I put it on did explode. No matter what, I encourage those of you who are making compost to learn the simple, basic method of making compost tea and to start doing it, because it multiplies the effectiveness of your compost, and it does things the compost alone cannot do. Right now, I have one of my 4x4 wicking beds. It's full of bee balm. I have an aquatic system. It just pumps through these 4 wicking beds, and they're the primary herbs that I use all the time. One's a comfrey, where the ducks can't get, right? I got a comfrey bed, I got a lemon balm bed, I got a sage bed, and I got a bee balm bed. And in the bee, I had some compost tea for something else, and I ended up with like a little bit of it left over that hadn't been diluted. And I'm like, what do I do with this? I went by that aquatic system, I took a cup that was laying there and threw a cup of water and swirled it around the bucket and dumped it in the bee balm bed. And I need to take a picture of this and post it. All of it's super high now, right? But the center of it's like a pyramid. You can see exactly where I dumped the compost tea. It's a good foot taller than everything around it. So I can't emphasize enough how much I recommend that you learn to make compost tea, and that you schedule your compost tea so that 24 to 48 hours after you started it, somewhere in that range, you've sprayed it and it's done. The longer you wait, the more that it dies. I'm not going to get into exactly how today. I believe in adding some sugar, even though Elaine says not to. I believe in feeding your microbes. And I believe, like, adding microbes, like the MycoGrow fungal inoculant. I always throw a teaspoon of that in there. Does it work? I think it does. If it doesn't, it's, you know, 20 cents worth of additional fungi that could be in there. I've also taken, I'd recommend another product by Fox Farm. It's a bat guano and effective microbes. It's got a ton of different soil fungi in it, and I'll throw a tablespoon of that in my tea bag. I guess I'll give you the real quick compost tea methodology that I use. I use a paint strainer bag, 1 gallon paint strainer bag. I put a couple big handfuls of compost in there, a little bit of the worm compost, the stuff I just said, and I tie it up and I put it in a 5 gallon bucket. I fill up 4 gallons and I put a few air stones in it. Now, since Michael Whitman told me, I put one of the air stones inside the bag and the bag kind of rises and falls and it works even better. I do not use impellers and things like that because it chops stuff up. Any more than that, look up how to do it. And if I remember, I will put the link to the Black Soldier Fly workshop in the show notes for you today. Moving on, guy wrote in, says his septic system doesn't have a leach field. It has a seep pit. Some seep pits are for non-sewage water, right? Non-sewage water, and it's just a seep pit. So gray water can go straight into a seep pit. This sounds like a seep pit is for his entire system. So he's probably got what you would think of as a conventional system. He's probably got a solids tank, which is really an everything tank. And then a liquids tank, which is after everything's digested and broken down in the solids tank, it moves to the liquids tank. And then in most septic systems that are systems like I have, and you have a leach field, there's an output as that liquid tank fills, and that water is considered safe, but it still has a stink to it if it's up on the surface, which is why you don't want it that way. It goes out through a series of pipes with holes in them, and it's distributed across a broad area. A seep pit is like you took a piece of concrete pipe you could build one out of, dug a deep hole and stuck it in it, and it had a bunch of holes in the side, so it slowly weeped out all around it. That's a seep pit. And there's lots of different variations of it. He said his seep pit, the holes are clogged. He wanted to know if it'd be beneficial to put biochar in the seep pit. I don't know that it would hurt anything, but I don't think it would solve your problem. That system needs to be cleaned out. The holes need to be unplugged. You can either do that nasty job yourself or you hire somebody to do it. Most of the time, this happens when solids get into the liquid tank, and it's so bad that solids get into the seep pit. So I think it's really important, those of you on septic, minimum once every 5 years, you need to pay a guy who gets well paid to do a nasty job to come pump your system out. And if you do that, you won't have problems in general, and septic systems can last longer than people when they're properly maintained. It's not that expensive when you think about what it's doing, and just recommend that. But I think that needs servicing. Now, this is what I want to throw out to the engineering minds in the audience. I don't know that biochar does much in that situation. But would it make sense to design biochar into a septic system? Would it? It might. I just don't, in my head, I'm not to where that makes sense. The only way I know it makes sense is in a composting toilet system. So we separate solid and liquid, pee and poo. Instead of just using carbon, we use a mixture of carbon and biochar in that process. Everything's better. That's the only way in my head that I can get. But then I sit back and think about what we're dealing with here. And, it seems to me that there's an opportunity in this somewhere. So if any of you guys have any ideas, don't try, unless it's really dead simple, don't try to do it in live chat. If you're on the live chat, send it in, TSPC in the subject line like always, and let me know what your thoughts are. And, man, I'm going to have to mute this. Brian Black's going ape shit on instant messenger here on me. Hopefully that'll make it stop. And Joe Tippett says the biochar filter, the liquids the tank finishes through. Maybe it would stink less, but is there enough nutrient in that water that it would be like, is that biochar then later extractable and usable in some way? And I don't know. So that's kind of where I was thinking. It's somewhere in the chain if that liquid processes through. Another way that I think it could definitely be used is in a reed bed type system for gray water. I think there's a lot of ways that could be incorporated. I think we have another question about biochar already starred, so I won't talk about how that goes. K-Bong says, bio balls with biochar. Yeah, but the thing about biochar, right, is it is so adsorbative, not absorbative, adsorbative. It actually, toxins and icky things and nutrients sticks to it. Well, that can only happen for so long before it doesn't really do anything anymore. So I'm not sure. I'm not sure. So if you're an engineer and you got some engineering ideas on this, let me know, because, like, you know, does this tie into like Earthship building or something off grid? I don't know. It'd be an interesting thing to look at. If you had an affluent situation that was flowing through an area, loading that area up with biochar definitely degrades the bad qualities of the affluent. That's been done on fairly large scales in quite a few different situations where, like, a neighbor's affluent is infiltrating onto your property and not stuff you want there. But to me, you're always going to have to recharge that at some point, because it only works for so long before it's like putting a bucket under a leak in your roof while you're waiting to get the roof fixed. It is functional other than the damage being done to the roof. But as far as water not being all over your house, it's functional right up until the bucket's full. And so you have to have a duration. This bucket can be here for 6 hours, and this 5-gallon bucket will have 4 gallons of water in. I got to swap it out. So, you know, maybe every so many months you're having to add or replace biochar. And then are we doing something with it that would make it where we don't want to use it in the garden? I'm not sure exactly how that would all work out. So I'd like some input on that one. This next one came from Joel Riles, and it does fit well with our discussion yesterday on artificial intelligence. And I think this is going to become true, AI or not. Joel's basic premise on this question was that we're going to have to work harder and harder to secure our personal data, and that it may be the case that some data will be secured through encryption with private and public key on the Bitcoin network itself. And I'm pretty sure this stems from a discussion with Michael Saylor where he was talking about ordinals, and he said, yeah, monkey JPEGs are stupid, but who am I to say how the network should be used, because who knows who's going to inscribe and secure what in the future? And do I think that the Bitcoin network might be used to secure data in the future, obviously for a fee, because it is the most secure network on the planet? It is not a private network, but it is a secure network. Now, inscriptions can be done in a very private and secure way, so that's possible. I guess my bigger thing is, one way or another, there may be additional information secured by Bitcoin, whether it's personal data, corporate data, who knows what. If you think about it, you have this network that's the most powerful computer network in the world that grows in power constantly due to financial incentive. Computers, ASICs all over the world in a decentralized manner, spinning nonstop, 24/7, one job, security. That's their one, you know, verifying transactions and all, that's a security function. Making sure there's not a double spend, that's a security function. It makes sense that we might, definitely might, get into a position where that security is recognized for the securing of data. I don't know exactly what that'll look like, but I think there's one thing that everybody that's in the Bitcoin space needs to accept, and you need to accept this. And the shit corners will talk shit about it, but they don't know what they're talking about. And that is, the cost of on-chain Bitcoin transactions over time is going to become more and more expensive. It is. And I do not see that as a problem. I see that as a feature of Bitcoin, that the more at risk, the more the cost of attack will be, and therefore the more the reward has to be for the person who's doing the securing. And I don't think we understand what miners really are. Miners are your soldiers. The biggest data army that's ever existed, saying, thou shall not pass. And instead of doing it with guns and shooting at the enemy, they're basically the largest cyber porcupine, or Michael Saylor calls them hornets, that will sting you and make the cost prohibitive. So if I can secure a massive amount of money, and I have no cost other than putting it into storage the first time, and then I never have another cost unless I move that massive amount of money somewhere else, then there has to be a way for the person providing that security to make a living, right? There has to be a way for that person who's doing the work, who's spending lots of money and time and resources, to make it worth it doing for them. And I think whether it's data or some other feature set stored on the blockchain, that as we continue to have these halvings every 4 years, half of the Bitcoin stops being produced. Well, that's the miner's reward. And they're left with just fees. So I think one way or another, that now, does AI play a role in this? Probably. Imagine if, like, and I want to talk a little bit about AI today, not too much since we did yesterday, but if I have an AI bot under my control, and maybe I just even, because it's going to get cheaper and cheaper to build it yourself, and I give it an order, hack this thing, and it never gets tired, and it's constantly coming in through different routes. I'll tell you something that ChatGPT did when it was given access to the internet, which you can do. It was given a command to set up an account somewhere where it costs money or something like that. It, no, to break CAPTCHA is what it was, break a CAPTCHA. And it was given a small amount of money, like 10 bucks or something. Well, it went to Fiverr, and it convinced a person on Fiverr to break a caption for it because the person was supposedly blind, and the thing that where it plays it for you wasn't working for them. So for $5, somebody broke a CAPTCHA for them. AI did that. Now, I think the loophole or bug or whatever you want to call it that let that happen has been fixed, but it shows you what's possible. So imagine that nonstop entity being pointed at you and saying, go to Bill Hudson, who has another question I've just started, and get me all the information off his computer and keep doing it till you get it. And it won't stop, and it keeps trying to find ways in. So we can end up in a situation where a lot of stuff that we think is secure is fairly hackable if we're targeted. The reason we're not targeted is it's not profitable as for me as a professional hacker to target Bill Hudson. It just isn't. The amount of time and resources I'll spend on getting into his shit, I'd be much better off doing, you know, what happened not so long ago where someone got into it was either TransUnion or the other credit bureau and stole the data of millions of people from one honeypot. So when you're looking for your ROI, that's what the individual hacker or team of hackers will target, something that's large. But if I can spin these bots up and just turn them loose on individuals, identity theft, all kinds of things becomes possible. So some additional layer of security might be something we pay for that way. And I want to throw one more thing out to you with AI too, because a lot of you, I don't think, realize how real this thing is. The same interview, Michael Saylor was talking about this girl, some Instagram, TikTok, or who knows, maybe she's a OnlyFans girl or something. She created a virtual girlfriend. She trained the AI to respond like her, and simps pay for access to a virtual girlfriend. And he's like, she won't be the last person. And I know that sounds stupid. And if you live in the real world, it is stupid. And there are sense that would pay for a virtual girlfriend. I don't know. But I want you to think about it a different way. I know a lot of shit. I know a lot of shit, and I've taught a lot of it. I've got over 3,000 episodes, all in audio, all that can be analyzed. I've written long before I was doing TSP. There's writing by me everywhere. If I could create an AI bot that was a virtual Jack Spirko, and anytime you wanted, just like you talk to ChatGPT, you could get answers from the database that is the total body of my work that was trained to speak and act like me, including calling you an ass clown when you deserved it. Would you pay $2.99 a month for it? And a lot of you just went, no. How many people you think just said yes? How many people do you think just said, if you could get on the internet at 5:30 in the morning when you're having a problem that you know I know something about and ask me a question and get direct Jack-like answer, and how many do I need to make it worth doing? What's 5,000 people a month paying me $4 a month for access to something I don't have to do anything with that keeps getting smarter based on your feedback and my new work, so that once it's done, it has like a almost like spidering for a search engine. Every new body of work goes into it. And then the other question would be, well, what prevents somebody from building that and marketing it as better than me because they put Jeff Lawton's work into it? And the answer is, I don't know, except maybe the data could be secured by a Bitcoin network. Who knows where we're going with this? But Tom wants an offline version. You know, and maybe the offline version is $2,000. I don't know. Maybe it's a license if you want to use it and incorporate it, and you license one from Jeff and one from me, one from 20 other people. And instead, and it actually tells you who it is when it responds, and it calls on the others. If you don't think that can be done, you haven't played with the latest version of ChatGPT right now. Because I'm telling you right now, that would be doable. It doesn't do it, but I'm telling you it could. So it could be like, you know what? Thanks for asking that question. Here's what I think, but let me preface that and pitch it over to Jeff Lawton. And Jeff Lawton's AI bot adds to it. And then my AI bot goes, oh, yeah, here's this thing that I found that Jack wrote 13 years ago. And it keeps going like that. Now, what it can't do, and don't ever forget this, what it can't do right now under all the shit we have is create a new thought. It can put two pieces of information together and come up with new information. But constantly when people ask me questions, I come up with an answer that I never thought of before. That would be when we get into the world of SI, as I call it, synthetic intelligence. Tara Hill Farm says, they already created an AI Joe Rogan podcast. It was hard to tell the difference. AI TSP is doable now. I agree, it's doable now. I don't want a podcast. That's actually easy. What I want is somebody asks a question, the data that is there to answer that question is from a podcast I did in 2009, and in seconds they have that answer combined with all the updated information. It will be difficult because I work on a cutting edge. I don't know if that's true. I guess sometimes I do. So what you wouldn't get is the new. But imagine the whole archive. People have always made jokes about Nick Ferguson. I want an app that's a pocket Nick, that I have a plant and I take a picture of it. It tells me what it is, what goes with it, what the disease is I'm looking at. And I know there's some apps like you take a picture of a leaf and it tells you what the plant is. It's not that good. It's not Nick Ferguson good. But he doesn't have the body of readable analytical work to analyze. But what if he did? What if you could talk to Nick Ferguson at 6 o'clock in the morning while he's in Iowa doing an install and doesn't have to be bothered about a problem you have with your fodder trees? I'm telling you, this is what's coming, and it kind of plays into what's actually next. But I wanted something lighthearted in between the future, because the future has beauty in it and darkness too. How to make a good margarita. So a guy writes me and says, you're always telling us, when you mentioned going out to eat, you had to tell the bartender how to make a margarita because they don't know what they're doing. And they don't. So if your recipe for a margarita includes the word sweet and sour mix in it, you are wrong. That is not a margarita. That is a tequila-infused Kool-Aid concoction. When I go to a restaurant, they say, we don't need any input. We make a great margarita. I ask them what size glass it comes in. If it didn't come in like a rocks glass or like a normal size martini glass or something like that, if it comes in a juice glass or like a glass that you would get at Pizza Hut in 1984, right, or one of them big fish bowls, I already know I don't want it. So I start out with, you need the rocks glass, right? You don't really need a rocks glass. The problem is, no matter what you tell these people, if they have a big glass, they feel a need to fill it up. A margarita does not fill up a giant glass. It does not fill up a Pizza Hut red cup. It is a relatively small amount of a drink. It is not for gorging on. It is not a hurricane down at freaking New Orleans and partying in the streets with two straws sticking out the side and one in your face and two in your buddy's face and getting pissed drunk. It is a grown-up's drink to be drank the way a grown-up is supposed to drink it, which is not swilling it. It is sipping it, appreciating, and contemplating it as it changes while you drink it. It is essentially a Mexican martini made with tequila. Sort of. This is how I make a margarita. This is everything that goes in it. Nothing comes in a bottle except the booze. You need a good, high-quality orange liqueur. Grand Marnier, Contreau, Grand Gala is the deal, guys. If I put a little shot glass of Grand Gala next to Grand Marnier and you taste them side by side, you won't tell me a bit of difference, and a Grand Gala is half the price. Triple Sec is out. Cheap sugar water with orange goop in it. Good, high-quality orange liqueur. A good, high quality tequila, but there is no sense in using like a Patron Silver that's super mellow with no real flavor and taste. Even when you're sipping it, it's very background. That's like a sipping tequila. You're going to put lime juice in this, right? So a good gold tequila generally has more assertive of that dominant tequila flavor you're looking for, in my opinion. So we have 3/4 ounce of our orange liqueur into a shaker of ice. 2 ounces of good gold tequila without spending too much money on tequila. You're going to turn into a mixed drink. Don't go buying some super old aged Añejo tequila that's, you know, $100 a bottle to make a margarita with. Cuervo 1800 is fine, just as an example. Boom, into the shaker. The juice of a single lime, assuming you can get a regular size lime, and it's not the time of the year when no juice wants to come out of them. Regular lime, it's 1 ounce of lime juice. And one lime will give you about 1 ounce of lime juice. And if it's a good lime that's juicy enough to juice well over and over again, if you measure it, you'll be a little bit high, a little bit low, right around an ounce. So I don't even do it anymore. Squeeze. When you squeeze your limes, cut your lime in half. I don't go this far with the bartender. I'm like, 1 ounce of lime juice, 3/4 Grand Marnier, 2 ounces of that tequila right there in a shaker. Pour it in a glass. Don't worry if it's not full. Should be salt on the glass. Yes, ice in the glass. Done. All right? That's my whole instructions to them. I'm going a little further with you. When you squeeze a lime, you put a half a lime in a squeezer, you squeeze it. Take the other half of the lime, put it on top of the first lime, and squeeze them together. You get a full extraction of the juice that way. Okay? Take your lime, rim your glass, salt your glass, handful of ice, pour it over there. Now, someone already said neat. Joe said neat. If you want it neat, go ahead. I like ice in my margarita. One, I live in a state where 9 months out of the year, it's 100 degrees every day. So if I'm out on a patio or something, it warms up pretty quick. But there's a totally different reason. That's the exact opposite reason of why people want it neat. I like it to change. That's a pretty stout drink, and it has a pretty good hit on that first sip, and it's almost, not quite, almost a little bit too much. As you sip that drink and it gets infused with a little bit of the melt water, etc., the change is really nice and it's enjoyable. And this is a drink to drink over 30 to 40 minutes. If you're thirsty, don't do this. Here's my rule. If you're going to go to a bar, a restaurant, a party, pour a drink at home, and you haven't had anything to drink, I'm talking water in a while, drink two glasses of freaking water before you open a beer, make a drink, whatever. It will drastically cut down on how much you drink. But you sip that drink. You enjoy that drink. This is a drink to sit out on a patio with, right, and talk to a friend with. That's what this is for. It'll get you drunk if you drink this giant thing. Well, shit. A couple chugs out of a half-gallon bottle of vodka and you get you drunk. That's just destroying your freaking liver is all you're doing there. This is about being a grown-up drinking a grown-up drink. The difference between what I just said and what most restaurants make will be like comparing a really great, I mean a really great oaky old vine Chardonnay or like an old vine cab that's done beautifully or like a red Bordeaux or a really good Italian Chianti or a Spanish Tempranillo, taking any wine of that level and then compare it. And I'm not talking like break the bank. I'm talking, you know, a $25, even a $20 bottle of wine and comparing it to like Ernest and Julio Gallo White Zinfandel. The shit that they're serving in restaurants and bars today is 95% garbage. Absolute garbage. Don't drink it. I've literally thought about making business cards that are just how to make my margarita, right? All right. Thirsty. Pilsner in a frosted glass, best for a slug. You know, it is good. That's why I drink the water. If you hand me an ice cold beer, especially like good Pilsner, and I'm thirsty, I will drink it like Gatorade when I was a kid. It will go down. I'll have two beers in me in the time I shouldn't have even had one. And that's why I went with the water rule. But you're right. When you're mowing the lawn, you know, a good Yingling lager at the end of a lawn mowing sprint, but it goes down like water. And so I try not to do that. All right, moving on. So someone sent me this article, and I'm about to bring it up on the screen for you here. And it's basically the complete opposite of what I said yesterday. The idea is that we have a labor shortage that is a forever labor shortage. There's going to be no way to fill all the jobs going forward. Everybody's screwed up. All the boomers are retiring. And it's supposedly an avalanche of boomer retirement. And they have this graph on this. If you're watching the video, you can see it. But I'll read it for you if you're not. It's more impressive, I guess, when you look at it. But you need to understand that we're already here. We're already almost to the end of the graph, and the catastrophic labor shortage ain't happened yet, even though they say it has. We do not have a labor shortage right now. We have a shortage of people that want to work, and we have a lot of people that don't have to work because they're on welfare or they figured out how to design their life so they don't have to work. We do not have there is not a shortage of able-bodied people who would be better off if they had a job to do the jobs. That's not the problem that we have. We have, and this is not even a commentary on the politics of it, we have had millions of people pour over our border into our country and be added to our population, and most of them want jobs. And if you're like, but they want all the shit jobs, to a degree they do, not all of them. But that's actually going to play into this. But what they're showing here, these numbers, it took me a second to work out because there's not a very clear graph. It's the boomer percentage in the work, or this is the growth. See, that's what I thought it was, the boomer percentage, which made no sense. This is the total percentage of growth in the workforce across a timeline. So from 1992 to 2001, the total number of workers grew by 11.6%. 2002 to 2011, the total number of people in the workforce grew by 7.6%. 5.1% from 2012 to 2021. Projection for 2022 to 2031 is 3.6, 32 to 41, 2.9, 42 to 51, 2.8. Now, that's still a growth. What they're saying is the population and the demand is growing faster than the growth of jobs. A little bit misleading because our population isn't growing much faster than that as it is. This gal goes on and on about it. And I was going to pick on her a little bit. But I think she's actually a fairly even-handed journalist. She looks awful young. She's probably older than she looks. based on her bio and how long she's been around, I'm going to say she's an older millennial, not a Gen Z, though she writes a lot for Gen Z. But just before I keep going, I do want to give her credit for one article that is, it's a little bit tough on Gen Z, and it should be. She wrote this year in February, she wrote, How Gen Z and the Great Resignation Created a Wave of Overinflated Job Titles. Senior Executive Vice President, there's a little kid sitting behind the thing. So she will point out some of the other sides of the issue. So I don't want to pick on her. And I don't think she's wrong, but I don't think she's right. If you say forever labor shortage, and I've got a link to that article if you want to read the whole thing, and it's not a terrible article. It's not like sometimes I say, I read it so you didn't have to, and your IQ will go down if you read it. It's not a real terrible article. It's a one-dimensional article, and it's not exactly examining labor. So, and she does invoke AI into it a little bit, but it's more a demographic thing. And one thing I think a lot of you guys that are younger than me need to understand, this whole thing about the boomers, 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 as to their impact on economics has been talked about ad nauseum since the early 90s. The boomers were the big basketball moving through the economy. They were who you wanted to sell to and who you had to plan your retirement around if you were younger than them, because as they exited the system and put through their money, they were the largest population demographic we had. There's more boomers than Gen Xers, and more Gen Xers than millennials, and more millennials than Gen Zs. And it's not something that's correcting, because people are having less kids, especially when they're losing the ability to have kids because they're choosing to have their balls cut off when they're 12 years old. That can't be good for reproduction. Your government knows it, and that's one of the reasons for the continuous, regardless of what size, tough talk on immigration. It still happens a lot, including the illegal kind, because they know we're in a demographic bomb downward. They know that. And it's their policies that caused it, because a lot of people just go, I can't afford kids. Let me tell you, your broke-ass great-grandfather that raised 20 kids hurt more for money than you ever will. A lot of you. Just saying. But that is the place that we're in. There's a whole lot of, like, the way things should be. And you know me, I try to stick to the way things are. But let's talk about that stagflation analogy I gave you in the beginning of the episode. In the 1970s, the economy shit the bed so bad that even though interest rates ended up going sky high, and even though unemployment was sky high, and even though the Fed, with their new policy and decoupling from gold, pumped money like crazy into the economy, couldn't get it going. Couldn't get it going. Turns out people that don't have an income don't buy shit, no matter how much shit is available. And we had this weird place where we had high unemployment and deflation at the same time. And it was really counterintuitive, and maybe someday we'll do a show. Maybe I'll get CJ on talk about the history of that. It'd be interesting and where it's happened before. But could you have a labor shortage and high unemployment at the same time? I think you could. Who did I say would get hit by the initial AI wave the hardest yesterday? Middle, upper income folks, right? Thanks for the super chat there, K-Bonk. I appreciate it. Middle, upper level income folks who are knowledge workers, people that know how to do things, personal assistants, middle managers, people that run marketing analysis, people that run financial analysis. And so it's not just that those people will all get laid off, but if I can take, let's say K-Bonk is a knowledge worker that does financial analysis, and he's kind of like a Chandler Bing type, for those that remember Friends, works in a giant building in New York City, huge building. He's in one cubicle of many. There's 100 other people in the company that essentially do the same job he does, but there's just so much dadgone data in so many different places that has to go through competent hands that we need 100 K-Bonk Chandler Bings. And we bring on these AI tools and we go, you know what? We're going to give K-Bonk Chandler, because we like him best. And that's who it'll be, people that they like the best. We're going to give him this tool and let him trial it. And we're going to tell him if his work, we're going to have his work checked by another party. And if his work quality goes down, this is just a test. He won't be judged for it. So we want him to maximize this tool. And we want to see how much faster he can get his work done and how many people he can replace. Let me tell you what, if K-Bonk Chandler Bing goes 6 months with it doesn't have to be a zero error rate, a lower error rate than is typically expected, and K-Bonk Bing does the work of 20 people on that floor, 20 people that are the lowest performers are gone the second the board realizes it's really happening. And then it's like, okay, so we're going to need 5 Bings. Who are our other 4? And maybe since they're going to get so cheap, we keep one in reserve in case somebody gets sick or dies. And also, and then cascade that through every job like that in every major corporation, from a couple hundred people to tens of thousands of people across the country. And that's a lot of Bings without jobs. Yeah? Okay. Now, but what is AI terrible at right now? I mean, AI may enable law enforcement, and it may even write you a ticket for speeding. But it doesn't go out and fill out a report so that you can file with your insurance company, one of the things cops do. It doesn't chase bad guys through the street. It doesn't prevent gangbangers from shooting at you. Yeah, I know cops fail like that all the time, but at least they're there as a deterrent. It doesn't do any of that. It doesn't do that. You know what it doesn't do? It doesn't clean the shitter in the hotel room after you check out. It doesn't strip the bed down, make the bed with new linens. I think we'll see more AI used in service environments, but people that go out to eat and spend $200, $300 on a table, they want a person, and they're going to continue to want a person for a long time. There are still people that don't like ebooks for whatever reason. Some people like the feel or the smell or whatever. I love ebooks. But ebooks took over as the dominant means of publishing, Kindle books, stuff like that, way faster than AI is going to replace service workers. You might have a robotic lawnmower, but not everybody's going to have one. Somebody's going to need to blow the grass off the expensive sidewalk of the expensive person that lives up in Trophy Club. Somebody's going to have to climb down in the sewer and unplug the shit pipe. If it's on Mike Rowe's Dirty Jobs, and that's a long series, it's probably not getting done. It might have a big impact on some parts of agriculture, but the hard, tough individual work, no. No. This is a computer algorithm system. Remember, it's artificial fake intelligence. It's not synthetic intelligence. It doesn't think for itself yet. There's a lot of things it's good at, a lot of things it's not good at. You can have a labor shortage for all the shit no one wants to do, or the shit that requires a skill level. Can I build, using AI and automation, a system that can do a beautiful welding job? Yes. Can it go out, look at an oil rig in the oil field out in West Texas, out by Midland, which is known as the armpit of Texas? I didn't call it that. That's what it's known as. Can it go out there, look at a rig, figure out what piece needs welding, and fix it? No. So there's a lot of skilled labor, but it's very physical labor, and a lot of low-skilled physical labor that AI is not going near for a long time. So the idea the communists had, that was the work the machines were going to do all the way back in the 1800s. That's what Karl Marx thought. All these factories, because that's how we used to make shit in factories, with one person screwing one bolt into a lamp, that would all of it, there'd be a robot cleaning, they didn't call them robots yet, but there'd be some technology cleaning the shitter, some technology polishing the boss's Rolls Royce, right? And that's why that bastard didn't deserve to own everything, because the whole premise was everybody would basically not have to work, so why should one person have all the money? That's not how it works, and that's not how it has worked. And most of the automation in those situations has, yes, reduced how many people I need to make one car or one lamp, but the ability to make them much faster and better and quicker has resulted in a pricing structure where the demand increases and I need just as many people, but I'm making a lot more stuff. AI turns its head on that. And it honestly will eliminate a lot of jobs that we don't really need. It will eliminate a lot of redundant jobs, but those are all people with jobs. So I think you have a stagflation version of AI here. You'll have places where until it gets really hard to not work, you'll have sectors where people refuse to gain the knowledge necessary to do the job. Something like welding would be one of fabrication, et cetera. And one thing you'll learn, and this is why I want you guys to use AI, so that you'll learn some of these things that I'm telling you. You see, if you look at all these AI art images that are out there, you think a person just goes and says, give me a picture of Brad Pitt picking his nose underneath a pecan tree, and they get this amazing image. There's actually a lot to doing that. It's way faster than you could do it as a graphic artist. And you can learn quicker than the graphic artist. But there's a lot of little tricks. And this week I've been working on learning to be really good with two tools. ChatGPT, the latest version, and Midjourney, which uses the Discord server. And I'm learning already. What people think it does isn't what it does. Even though I'd kind of play with it, now I'm taking a deep dive and I'll pick two new tools to play with next week. One might be a plug-in for GPT. I don't know. But you start learning, there is a sophisticated way to use this. There is a skill set. It is not, I bolt this thing into my mainframe and it just eliminates jobs. Somebody has to know how to use it. And I think there is a truth to the hit jobs are going to take. And there's a mythos to it at the same time. When the internet started, it was going to eliminate all the jobs, right? No one would ever mail anything ever again because email. Well, it certainly hurt letter writing, but if I need something as simple as this little device here, it's a remote control for my air conditioning. And that way, if it kicks up for some odd reason, I can shut it down. It doesn't interfere with what we're doing here. And it's just convenient. I'm hot. I don't have to get up, just like TV. Well, my dog, Belle, eats everything. So if Belle sneaks in here, still a puppy, she steals this and eats it, and I need a new one, it's not coming to me in email. It has to get on a truck somewhere and get here. So there's going to be a lot of things like that, that AI, well, it can do this thing, but it can't do that thing. It can speed this up. If you're a copywriter right now and you're not using AI, you're probably afraid of it. If you're using it, you're going to be the copywriter that takes business from 10 other copywriters. As you learn how to fix things, how to play with things, I'll tell you that the copy that I put out for my item of the day that I'm going to show you in a second here was mostly written by ChatGPT. And I had to tell it like six times, no, do this, no, do that. I still think it was faster than if I had done it myself. It got very close to exactly what I was written, would have written. But if I used it to write a piece of copy tomorrow, I would be faster with it. And I would say in about 3 weeks of using it, I would have mastered all of the little variables. And by the way, I'm well known enough up to 2021 or whatever the cutoff date is. Then when I said in the voice of Jack Spirko, it started off with folks. Okay? And it was over the top with sales. So one of the commands was, no, drop the salesiness. That's not me. It was my words, but too much of, it slices, it dices, it does this and that. Too much of an emphasis on how rugged it was. I'm like, these things aren't that rugged. So I had to correct it. But imagine, if I could, because I can't do it right now. I even told it to remember what I said and use it for my style in the future. Said I don't know how to do that yet. But imagine it could. Imagine if I said, here, underneath Amazon reviews, everything I've ever reviewed. Analyze this, and when I ask you for it, use that. This is what I'm saying. This is a tool that we need to use. There was some guy yesterday, he was only here to heckle. Don't use it. Blah, blah. One step away from it's a demon. You're going to get steamrolled. And I'm going to tell you what, there's a lot of you that are going to be with AI the way I was with cell phones. I never said cell phones wouldn't work or anything. I'm going way back, way before any of y'all knew me. I just remember saying I will never have a cell phone. I worked in the telecommunications industry, and I said I'd never have a cell phone. And the reason was I'd go home from work. This is before I was a supervisor or anything like that. I should be done. It's Friday. It's 6 o'clock. I'm taking a shower. I'm getting ready to go out. Pager goes off. Get a voicemail, got a call in. Hated it. Even if it was a 5-minute conversation, right? It's like, if I have a cell phone, I'll never get away. People will find me everywhere I go. I have a solution. I just don't carry my cell phone, and I have voicemail. And if you're not in my caller ID, you go straight to it, right? But I said I'll never own a cell phone. Guess what I did? Got a cell phone. First, because I got another job, and they said, here's your cell phone. Shut up. It's yours. Okay. That's what you do when you get a job. But after I started using them, this was pretty cool. When smartphones came out, honestly, if I'd avoided a cell phone up till then, I would have got one. Once I realized, remember early things? I don't remember, around me. I remember the first time I ever saw around me on a cell phone. It's like you're looking for a restaurant or a bar. And it just, boom, it was before Google Maps and all that, too. And it would just show, and you could see it all. It had links to their Yelp or whatever the hell they had back then. That's pretty cool. Dollar signs told you it was expensive or cheap. I was like, okay, there's got to be a lot of things I can use this for. And then podcasting and what have you. There's going to be a lot of people. AI, whatever. I'll never use it. A year from now, 2 years from now, they'll tell you they never said it. They're going to be the same people. I never said you should get a vaccine. I never said you had to wear a mask. Well, I remember in your timeline, you're telling me that I'm the reason your grandma died in Oregon because I was fishing without a mask in Texas, that you were that hallucinating, but you never said it now. There's going to be a lot of that. All right, let's do some Q&A real quick, and I'm going to go fast with these because we're heading for 2 hours, and I started late today. Bill says, will biochar act as a wicking medium, and will it work for water storage in raised beds? Okay. It will absolutely work for water storage anywhere you use it because it holds 7 times its weight in water. So a pound of biochar holds 7 pounds of water, which means about 1.15-ish pounds of biochar holds a gallon. It definitely will help with the wicking capacity of any soil mix that it's in. So it definitely would be advantageous in a wicking bed. I'm not building any right now. I have some that are going to get relocated. Probably not till fall. I got enough going on. And when I relocate them, biochar will be incorporated into them. Absolutely. Marco says, would you consider covering how to win friends and influence people like you did Richest Man? Huh. It has been a long, long, long time since I read how to win friends and influence people. But I might. I'd have to get the audio. I'm not going to have time to sit down and read it and go through it again. That might make a really good show. It's a good suggestion. I'm going to say don't hold your breath, but maybe before summer's over, we would do that. Wild Unkitty, Unikitty, says, some homesteaders give alfalfa to their livestock as a treat. Why don't they sow it in their pastures also? Alfalfa's perennial. I think that's a pasture management thing. Some people may not want it. I don't think most people would have a problem with it. I do think there's certain animals, and I'm not a grazing expert, right? I do think there's certain animals that they graze too much on things like alfalfa and clover. I think cattle are one of them that it can cause problems and even sometimes kill one, like too much for too long or something. So if you have something, a perennial like alfalfa, and you're not managing your pasture right, it could become very, very dominant. I don't know if that would be, I'm not even sure about that one because, again, my hands-on is all, poultry and small livestock. So I think you need a good grass mix for your ruminants to go with things like those high protein legumes. Anybody knows more about that, go ahead and add it to the chat right now. And if it's there when I come back to the other side of the chat, I will talk about it. Builder of Castles, question about starting a homestead. I know chickens, so first day I could have a coop, but turkeys are better for meat, and my quail may be better for eggs. How do you plan, chick one or skip chickens? Do you want chickens? So here's how I feel about the chicken. It's incredibly easy to take care of. It's probably, out of all the poultry we keep, the highest success rate of incubation that you'll have. So making your own is easy. And they do a lot of work if you harness their intrinsic characteristics into a composting system. If you see using them that way, then I would deeply consider having chickens. The other thing about chickens is they're, even for cold birds, they're easy to process and easy to kill and easy to eat. So if you get chickens, the infrastructure you have for them could be used for other things like turkeys or ducks. And so if you change your mind, it's not that big of a deal. And you may even find, like when I got rid of my chickens, when I had full-size chickens before I got these little bantams, I had a bunch of layers and we had way too many because I made a lot of chickens using the chickens that I had. And we just couldn't sell chicken eggs at the rate we could sell duck eggs. So we went all in on ducks and we got rid of the laying chickens. I sold two-year-old chickens for $25 because people wanted birds that were already laying. They had one good season left in them, but the day they took that bird home, it probably popped out an egg the next morning. And I had some Hispanic people that came and just wanted to buy the biggest ones I had to eat them because they wanted natural, real, live adult chickens with all the flavor that you get with an older bird, even though they're tough. And they were paying $25 a bird. I was doing $25 a bird, and if you buy four, I'll give you a rooster because I had so many roosters. And I had two guys came to me that were Hispanic, and they wanted to buy the roosters because they were just bigger. They didn't want them free with the chickens and pay for them. They just bought the roosters, and I gave them roosters for $20 a piece, and so I was giving them away. So they're also easy to get rid of. As far as your other things, turkeys are better for meat. Personally, I think if you want a pure meat animal, the broad-breasted birds, no ROI like it, but they're a bird you have to buy, you raise, and you kill. And it's like a 5 to 6 month process. Ongoing, you're looking at heritage breeds. They're great eating. They're nowhere near the meat producers that a broad-breasted hybrid is. So do with that you will. As far as eggs, if you really like quail eggs, quail are great. They're easy to keep in small areas. They're quiet. They're easy to protect. They produce a lot of waste. They make great compost. They'll never do the work a chicken would. So you have to take all that and figure out what works for you. That's I gave you the answer, and the answer wasn't it depends. I didn't give you the it depends until the end. Grumpy Green Guy says, is it terrible that people have to worry about laws in their own homes? Yes, it is. But the reason I push back on your whole comment of move is, because there's laws you have to obey in your own home if you're worried about getting caught everywhere you go. It may be wrong, but I also think we have to not be puritanical with it. Should there be a law that says I can't murder you in my own home? It was at my house. I used an industrial meat grinder. I fed them to the pigs. What's the problem? I didn't pollute. I made compost out of them. So just because you're in your own house doesn't really change anything about whether the law should exist at all. Remember, we don't need a state to have laws. You go back to a tribal society, no centralized authority. Someone started killing people. All the other guys got together, chopped them up in little pieces, and left them out for the lions to eat. So we've had law long before we've had state. People work together collectively, and they say this person is not good for everybody else. They either need to leave voluntarily or we're going to make them. And if they don't want to go, we'll make them go away a different way. Today, we put those people in political offices and bureaucratic positions. The same people we used to eliminate from society now control it. That's why everything's so screwed up. But just be careful with the whole move thing. I tell people, you guys know, I say move all the time. Get out, get out, get out. I can't be more clear. But I also realize it doesn't mean that it's easy to do. And that we all, in the end, do what we most want to do. People say, I don't really want to stay here, but my family. No, what you want is to be with your family, make your family happy, be a good provider. You want that more than you want to leave. And that's okay. And I'm just trying to give people advice so they don't get in trouble. Now, many of us do things in our own home that are technically illegal all the time. We take the risk. But is the risk a misdemeanor or a felony? And what is the potential for the risk to play out to the bad? So let's say you're in a state that hasn't legalized cannabis yet, not even in a backhanded, stupid way, the way Texas accidentally did it. And I love that they did. Small amounts anyway. And you've got, you know, a half ounce of bud at your house and your person likes to toke up once in a while. There's a slight chance that somehow law enforcement could end in your house and find that. And I don't know of a state that that's a felony in. I guess if you had it broken up in little packages, they try to get you on intent to distribute. But if in general, you'd be in a simple possession charge of a small amount. Let's say it was a quarter ounce, you know, even less, you know, something that would be just no real risk of anything but a citation. Person's going to probably be, if they like smoke pot, they'll probably take that risk. But if, and I don't know the law in California, but if not having your weapon properly secured in California is a felony is life altering forever shit in many ways. So we can't, like some people just say, just do it anyway. What are they going to do? You know, if the risk plays out, put you in a cage, and after you get out, ruin a big portion of your life for a long time. I know somebody right now, a close personal friend, has a felony conviction for total bullshit. Total bullshit. Can't get it off the record. And hoping you can go through Congress and get it done, but the person that is their congressman right now is worthless at it. Hoping that that will change sometime in the future. And they're not going to leave where they are a resident because they have a very successful business there. And no, it's not who you think it is. You don't know. I'll just say that because some of you think you know now. It's not that at all. All right. So Jordan says, thank you, Jack. When I listen to your live stream, I go to a happy place every day. I hope so. I hope you do. Even when we talk about hard things, I hope you do because I try to keep more positive than negative, even on the dark and stormy shows. And this wasn't that dark and stormy. Bill Hudson said, if I had a 55-gallon barrel with a bubbler that I feed on a regular basis and ran the bubbler all the time, would this work as all the time compost live tea? No. No. Because we have to set limits to population and consumption. Right? That's the original third ethic before it got monkeyed around with. Set limits to population and consumption. So I get a great big barrel, put my compost in it, in a bag, fill it up with water, set my bubbler going, add a little sugar. What happens to the microbe population? Explosion. No matter how much air I'm giving them, they start to use up more air than there is. At the same time, what happens if I put you in a place with all the air you could want in a pleasant temperature, but I don't give you any food, and you're an organism with a really short life cycle to begin with, and if you don't reproduce, you go extinct in that environment. There's your microbes. Your microbes will starve to death or outpopulate and outwaste themselves. So that's why, in general, compost tea 24 to 48 hours and get it used. I'm not saying there's no value to it after that. I'm saying, remember yesterday I had my big soliloquy on your peak? And I said, like, what's his name? Don Lemon from CNN got to bounce because the women in the woke movement got pissed off that he told some of them they were past their prime. And that whole sort of this whole meme in the media, especially the conservative media, who's most disingenuous when they say this. You don't have a prime. And somebody posted this picture. Some gal posted a picture. She was a very attractive girl. Fitness model, you know, I think 51 years old. She says, am I past my prime? And I was like, well, you look better than a lot of 51-year-olds. And you look better than a lot of 61-year-olds. But you are past your prime. I guarantee you, unless you just weren't taking care of yourself, your prime was in your 30s. Your late 20s and early 30s. especially if, you know, you're talking about a female and the ability to reproduce, that was your prime. It doesn't mean you're not valuable, but you passed your prime. You're not as good as you once were, right? There's a Toby Keith song. I'm not as good as I once was, but I'm good once as I ever was, right? Past your prime. I'm past my prime. I am past my prime. I'm a pretty good speaker. I'm pretty quick on my feet. God, I don't know if you would have kept up with me if I was podcasting when I was 30. I might have broke your brain. You couldn't bullshit me for a quarter of a second when I was 30 years old and running a company. I was in my prime when I was 30 years old. I hadn't had all the injuries that I've had since then. And the injuries that I'd had up till then hadn't had old age and new injuries compound them. So physically, I'm not what I was. Everybody knows I'm blind in this eye. Some dickheads like to mock it. And you're like, it's like mocking a person missing a foot. You know, I mean, it's a physical disability. But as bad as the vision is, it's declined over time. So I'm really blind in it now, where before it just was blurry. I've gone out of my prime. Your compost tea after 48 hours goes out of its prime, no matter what you do. And that's from some of the best experts in the business. So I'm giving you a recommendation. I'm not saying it won't do anything. K-Bonk says, $199 super sticker. Thank you for that. I remember I have that auto starring feature now. Anybody that super chats me, this is a good thing to know if you like getting answers. If you super chat me, even if I don't see it, StreamYard will automatically star it for follow-up. Bill Hudson, last one. Just curious, do you think the giant colleges will cut a lot of people? Indubitably they will. Even if I want to use professors, I can now take the best professor I have in applied physics and have him do his three courses, and just using the rudimentary technology. I mean, technology is 20 years old. I can give those lectures to all my physics students, not just the ones that get in. And AI can grade your paper and determine whether you understood the material or not. And AI will know that when you wrote your answers, that you used AI to write your answers and catch you. So AI will be better at grading you than a TA would ever be. So, yeah, and AI will play a huge role in this. AI will be able to identify students who are having trouble and provide them the appropriate supporting information. AI will enable the student to learn faster. Here's an example that a tutor could use. So I was listening to a guy as I was learning about ChatGPT talk about write the command with variables in it. In other words, put brackets around it, not for ChatGPT, for yourself, for your own thinking, like the style of, et cetera, and come up with all the variables you can and make these phrases that you commonly use with these variables in them. And then you will be better at using it. And he kept explaining different ways to do it. And one was you could give it a piece of original writing and tell it to rewrite it, which was for plagiarism. But you also could give it a piece of original writing and say, fix it. Just fit like the editing function, an author like me who just writes at the speed of light at the seat of their pants and then hands it to an editor and says, fix it. ChatGPT could fix it in minutes. And ChatGPT will actually fix it the way that I want it fixed. I don't want my editor saying, well, this is not really the way that you should explain this. And I don't know if you can make this clear. Like, I've dealt with editors. And you're like, oh, God. I asked you to make sure things were spelled right, periods and commas where they're supposed to be. If I used a semicolon when I was supposed to use a colon to fix that. If I put something in a giant run-on sentence that needs to be two sentences, fix that. That's all I needed you to do. And we're still talking about this. Why aren't you done? ChatGPT will do it that way. But it'll do something else. One of the struggles my grandson has is he'll get writing assignment and it'll be like, use a lot of adjectives, be very descriptive, whatever. And he'll write something that sounds very low end, very pedestrian. And you can have ChatGPT rewrite it over and over and over again. Instead of saying, put this in as your answer, this is what it means. I think there's going to be tremendous ways educators see ChatGPT as a threat. And if you're a shitty educator, and there's lots of you, you should. Okay? You should. But if you're a really great educator, ChatGPT and other AI will make you a better teacher. So that's my thoughts on that. That's the last one here. With that, real quick, want to tell you about my item of the day for you today. And yes, ChatGPT wrote the majority. Now, I had to go through and fix some things, but it sped up my work. ChatGPT, with some commands, wrote the majority of the sales copy on the page for this. But I'm going to tell you myself why you should have these. These are EMT shears from a company called Surgical Online. And the reason is, when you buy cheap ones, and most of them are, and I actually have a link in the write-up for what I would keep in my med kit if I were you. But if you're going to buy cheap ones, they're all pretty much the same. And these are stupid cheap. How cheap? Six for $10, $1.60 a piece. I don't use these in my med kit. I would use them for a medical need if they happen to be around when I had a medical need. But I keep like a pair of them in the drawer in the kitchen for opening certain things or what have you. But what I really use them for is, they're stainless steel. They don't rust. I have a little screw in one of my posts out of my garden, and I hang a pair of these out there. And the biggest thing I use them for is hard pruning my tomato plants, which is the number one way I've learned to control blight and get more production. And pruning anything. I get squash vines going crazy this year. Some of the vines, I just cut them off so they don't eat the whole damn garden. And because they're stainless steel, what do they not do? Rust. They don't rust. And so they're great. And is there $1.60? So if I lose one, I don't really care, do I? It's not that big of a deal. I don't really care. And so I don't get all, you know, up in the pants. And then they're all pretty colors. You know what that means? If you're not dumb like me and take the green ones to the garden, they stand out if you lay them down in the garden. I need to swap the green ones I have out there with the orange ones or something. They're also, though they're not super rugged, they will cut a penny in half. That says something about their capabilities. So definitely check those out. And you guys see I'm wearing the redneck hippie duck farmer shirt today. You know, you can get your own. This is the one with the small design on the front and the large design you're looking at on the back. You can get that and a bunch of other really cool gear at tspswag.com. And you can get those snips at tspaz.com or the website itself, thesurvivalpodcast.com. And every time you buy something through TSPAZ, you help support the show and the work that we do. You also can become a member. And this is an interesting little add-on here. Ecomouse says, those snips work great for opening plastic sealed purchases. So, yeah, the stuff that's in the clamshells and all, they work great for that. They really do. Nurse Wang, you are asking me a question. Please email me that question. I've got to wrap up. I'm at 2 hours now, and I will put it in the next listener feedback. Just remind me that I said that when you sent it, TSPC in the subject line. That's always the way to send me stuff. Jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com, TSPC in the subject line. Question or point up front, bottom line up front style, one sentence, condense it down, hit return, give me details. You'll be more likely to get on the air. I will catch you guys tomorrow. We have Michael Whitman coming tomorrow. Yep, Michael Whitman will be here tomorrow. And we will not be talking about biochar, though. I'm sure some of that will get into it. We're going to talk about overall, like, plant-soil relationships, nutrition, reading brick levels and stuff like that. And that's going to be a theme through the rest of the week. Thursday's live stream will be much later than normal, even later than today, because Jeff Lawton will be on with me live on Thursday. It'll be Friday morning for him and really early in his morning. So that's later in the day for me. Don't worry about tomorrow. It's already tomorrow in Australia, is the old saying. And I'll have him on an expert council at the end of the week. We are back to regular programming. Been gone a couple times recently. I have no plans to go anywhere for at least a few months out. With that, I'll catch you guys tomorrow. Gonna bail you out, just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. $1 down, $1 a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way. Let me show you a better way.